Hubert Vernon, Rudolph Clayton, Irving Wilson, Alva Anton, Jeff Harley, Timothy Curtis, Cleveland Cecil, Ollie Edmond, Eli Wiley, Marvin Ellis Espinoza was too old to be at a communist party. At 27, he had 7 years on the next oldest partier. He felt the demographic void. He wanted to hide behind one of the enormous filthy machines that dotted the floor of the derelict factory. Anything to escape the frank, flat looks from the beautiful children of every shade and size who couldn't understand why an old man was creepering around. "Let's go," he said to Seth, who dragged him to the party. Seth was terrified of aging out of the beautiful children demographic and entering the world of non-work. He had an instinct for finding the most outré, cutting-edge, transgressive goings-on among the children who'd been receding in their rearview mirrors. Hubert etc. Espinoza only hung out with Seth because part of his thing about not letting go of his childhood was also not letting go of childhood friends. He was insistent on the subject, and Hubert etc. was a pushover. "This is about to get real," Seth said. "Why don't you get us beers?"
Welcome to Between the Covers, a weekly KBOO program all about books and the people who write them. I'm your host this week, Ken Jones. On today's show, our guest is Cory Doctorow, author of the new science fiction novel, Walk Away. In addition to his role as sci-fi novelist, Cory's a technology activist, journalist, and blogger. His work includes the nonfiction book, Information Doesn't Want to Be Free, the novels Makers and Down and Out in the Magic Kingdom, the young adult novels Homeland, Pirate Cinema, and Little Brother, and the graphic novel In Real Life. Cory's an MIT Media Lab research affiliate, a visiting professor of computer science at Open University, co-founder of the UK Open Rights Group, and co-editor of the website Boing Boing. One of my favorite quotes about Cory's new novel comes from Edward Snowden, who wrote, "A dystopian future is no way inevitable. Walk Away reminds us that the world we choose to build is the one we'll inhabit." Cory Doctorow, thanks for coming into KBOO today.
Well, thank you very much for having me again, Ken. It's nice to be back.
And on Mother's Day, too, so I really appreciate it. Cory, the last time we talked at KBOO, about 2.5 years ago, you had just published your nonfiction book, Information Doesn't Want to Be Free, and you ended that book by writing that while all of us are terrible at predicting the future, you have fear and hope. And I actually asked you to wind up that interview, what's your fear and what's your hope? In a way, your new novel, Walk Away, seems to be a pretty good answer to that question.
Yeah. You know, there's a great law review paper written by Michael Weinberg when he was at Public Knowledge, writing about 3D printing. And the title was something like, "This will all be so great if we don't fuck it up." And when I look at technology, I see all of the possibilities for using it as a tool of liberation and of allowing us to work together to make a better world, and also how it could be used to surveil us, to control us, to make inequality more unequal. For me, the challenge isn't whether technology is good or bad, but what are the good and bad ways of using technology?
And in the book, you have both the dystopia, so the bad ways technology is being used, and the utopia. There are two worlds, basically. There's the default world, which is somewhat recognizable to most of us here, kind of the everyday world in the perhaps not too distant future, and the walkaway world, which is a utopian alternative, which doesn't seem something that's available to us right now. The default reality is run by these very wealthy, which is very recognizable, and you call them the Zada rich or Zadas. And the default world in that case is not really that big a leap from the present day. You had mentioned in that recent Wired article we had talked about before the interview, the difference between utopia and dystopia isn't how well everything runs. It's about what happens when everything fails. Can you apply that to these two worlds?
Sure. Well, so I want to say that although Walk Away touches on some very lofty and abstract ideas, that it is a science fiction adventure novel. I'm a pulp writer in the most celebratory sense of that word, right? Not in a non-pejorative way. And pulp stories work in service to their plot, which is great. It makes them so much fun to read. There's this great quote from William Gibson in the Paris Review where someone asks him how he relates to snooty literary writers who look down their nose at him for writing science fiction. And he says, "You know, when I meet one of those people, I think at the very least, I can plot, by God. You know, my tractor's got wheels on it. And so when you're doing plotty kind of fiction, you can ask the readers to suspend a lot of disbelief in the service of the plot. And in pulp, we have the man versus man story and the man versus nature story. And then we like these disaster stories that are kind of a twofer, where we have man versus nature versus man. So, you know, the earthquake knocks your building down, your neighbors come over to eat you. And that is a not very realistic rendition of what happens in times of crisis. I took much of my inspiration in this book from Rebecca Solnit's Paradise Built in Hell. It's a beautifully researched and beautifully written history book about just how great people are in times of crisis, how they pull through, how they cover themselves in glory, how they rise to the occasion, and how rich people are convinced that the poor are coming to eat them. And rather than ask you to suspend your disbelief in this novel about people in times of crisis turning on each other, and the crisis in this case is the economic crisis of there not being any reason for most of us to exist as far as the rich are concerned, mm-hmm. and also the environment slowly crumbling. I have these people act in a way where the drama is constrained not by their enmity, but by their friendship, where they all want to make a better world. They all like each other, and yet they can't agree. Mm-hmm. And yet they are at each other's throats. Not because they're enemies and not because they're horrible, but because they are principled and because they love each other. And I think that the drama that comes from that, you know, the service to the plot that a pulp novelist has as their duty, is actually heightened as compared to saying, oh, we'll just pretend that everyone will turn on each other. Because, you know, the stakes are very high when you have an irreconcilable difference with someone you like and respect. You know, no one ever went to bed kicking themselves for winning an argument with a friend, with an enemy rather. But if you win an argument with a friend, you might find yourself lying awake, unable to sleep, and wondering whether or not the friendship will ever be recovered.
Pyrrhic victory.
Yeah. And so there's a really intense drama, I think, that comes from this. And there's a parallel to some of the other work I've done. You know, with Little Brother, my young adult novel, I said, well, let's take the techno-thriller convention of saying that computers' capabilities will be made subservient to the plot. So we'll, if a computer needs to be able to do something impossible, we'll just pretend it can do it. And if there's something computers do all the time that we wish they couldn't do so that the plot would be served by it, we say, all right, we'll just take that capability away from them. The reader's asked to come along with you. And I said, instead, what if we made the constraints of computers and the capabilities of computers into the crux on which the story turned? And not only does that free up the finite resource of suspension of disbelief to be dedicated to the characters instead of the impossible elements of the story, but it also gives the story a kind of immediacy that makes it feel like not like a fantasy novel where the problems are problems that you ultimately will never face yourself, but like a novel that is consequential, like the problems that you're reading about are problems that you might have to face in your own life imminently. And I think that that's such a nice move in pulp plotting. I relate it to Brian Eno's aphorism that you should strive to be the first person to not do something that no one else has ever thought of not doing before. And I really think that works great.
So you're using pulp as kind of a way of getting to the reader to get these points across. But as you say, it is a rousing adventure story in many ways. And you were initially, as a very young boy, were inspired by Star Wars.
Yeah, that's right. Yeah, the first story I ever wrote was after coming back from the University Theater in Toronto in 1977, having seen Star Wars with my dad, and we parked the family dinosaur, and I got off and went inside and got some scrap paper and folded it and stapled it up the side and trimmed it to the size of a paperback novel. And I wrote it the Star Wars story over and over again, like a kid practicing scales, partly because it was such an exciting adventure story, but partly because the kind of narrative available in 1977 to a six-year-old was very thin. You know, about half the kids' programming that I got to watch was Davy and Goliath, which is this free...
I know it well.
You know, I mean, it was produced for free by the Methodists and distributed to networks to air... as instructive material. You know, the theme song was a hymn written by Martin Luther. Talk about something that is far from being rousing adventure stuff.
I don't remember the theme song, but I remember the show well.
It's yeah. if you
look
go
it
back
up.
And listen.
Yes.
Yeah, it's on YouTube, obviously.
I know it's a boy and his dog.
Yeah,
and there was always a moral at the end.
That's right.
Now, in our current situation in the U.S., and you were born in Canada, you lived in London, actually, last time we talked. You're in Los Angeles right now.
Yeah,
so
Burbank.
You have a very wide perspective, wider than mine. One party controls the executive branch, both houses of Congress. Many Americans believe that our only hope to change things rides on voting them out, starting with the 2018 midterm elections. But in the world of Walkaway, that's clearly futile. There's a quote in the book from one of the main characters, actually the first person we meet. I'll call him Hubert, et cetera, mm-hmm. though he has about 20 other names too. One of the main characters who says, I want to talk to my parents. Last couple years, we've hardly spoken. It's not like we don't get along. I love them, but we had less and less to say. They tell me what they were doing, getting petitions signed or ringing doorbells to get voters out for some election everyone knew was gerrymandered to five nines. And voter suppression, let's add that to the gerrymandering. And it's pretty much how things got the way they are today. But in Walkaway, you offer a much more effective alternative, just walking away. I'm interested in what you think are the prerequisites for a world like that, where people can walk away. I mean, it's very tempting right now.
Well, I think that I think that there are really four forces that move our world. And I get this from Lawrence Lessig, that there's code and law and norms and markets. And so what is legally permissible, which is a way of saying who we elect, has a huge effect on what we can do. But so does what is morally acceptable. And so does what is profitable. People do more of what's profitable. And so is what's technologically possible. And Walkaway is a story about people who, when they reach the limits of what the law can do, decide that they will use technology to do something normative. They will just say this system's legitimacy has collapsed, and so we're going to walk away from it. And the reason they're able to do that is they have technology that allows them to network themselves and work together with very little institutional support. So I'm a great believer in Ronald Coase, who won the 1937 Nobel Prize in Economics, having written in this paper, The Theory of the Firm, where he supposes that the reason we build all of our institutions, nonprofit radio stations, the Catholic Church, the Mafia, the U.S. government, and, you know, the Walt Disney Company, is to coordinate people's labor, to let people work together to do more than any one individual can do with the lowest possible overheads, right, to spend less time, you know, on org charts and meetings and more time or undoing the work that someone else has just done because they did it wrong and more time getting the work done. And the Walkaways, they have the software that is a kind of metaphor or parable about the software tools we have now that let us do things like build encyclopedias and other kinds of software.
GitHub and Wikipedia.
GitHub, Wikipedia. That where we... People who don't know each other and who don't agree on why they're doing something and who don't agree on how it should be done and who often never directly communicate can all contribute to something. And when they reach irreconcilable difference, they can fork it into two different parts and they can continue down different routes. And sometimes they re-merge after forking. And I imagine how that might be applied to the project of building a community, like an actual physical community where people live and they build, in this case, mad luxury hotels owned by no one that anyone can stay in, that are kind of sybaritic palaces, but built the way that we build Wikipedia, mm-hmm. where literally people can take down a wall if they think it's in the wrong place. And, you know, I gave a talk about this at Google at the start of the tour, and a Google engineer said, I wouldn't want to be in a skyscraper built like Wikipedia. And I said, nobody thought that they should use an encyclopedia built by Wikipedia until all of a sudden it was all anyone used. And he was like, you know, you're absolutely right.
He rethought that. I actually had a question on that because
sure.
In previous interviews also about the book and definitely in the book, you emphasize the importance of cooperation and collaboration, working as a team, as opposed to kind of the superstar individual. Mm-hmm. And I worked at I worked at Microsoft for many years, so I've seen this. A lot of teams had that kind of rock star programmer who was very difficult to get along with. And you make a point that even more important than that rock star programmer, and that may sometimes be a detriment to the team, is what you call the team wizard, somebody who can get everybody working together, smooth over their differences and see how they fit together. Do you think that's an essential part of not just a successful project, but a successful society?
Yeah, I mean, the people who can figure out how to reconcile other people's differences, which sometimes is a matter of saying, you know, here are two non-intersecting parts of the same project you guys can go work on in your own corners without having to talk to one another. And sometimes it's about finding common ground and actually figuring out how people who don't like each other can find a way to like each other or respect each other enough to work together. But those people, they make the world go round. You know, people who can build coalitions make the world go round. And one of the things that is fascinating in the 21st century is that group forming has got much, much cheaper. Getting together with other people who want to do the same thing as you has never been easier than it is today. So, you know, we're sitting here in KBOO, which is a radical radio station. You told me that you've got all these new security measures because you're politically radical and you're facing potential security
under
threats.
The Trump administration.
Under the Trump administration. Organizations that face security threats simply for existing pay a very high price to bring in new members because they don't know if those members are going to be agent provocateur or if they're just going to be so sloppy that they'll endanger the group. And so they tend to be very sectarian, not because they're stiff-necked or mm-hmm. incapable of understanding that, you know, this is the traditional critique lobbed at the left. It's like, well, if only you people would just abandon your purity politics, you could get a lot more done. It's not like people don't understand that. Mm-hmm. But what they know is that if you have to spend 100 hours to get someone in, and then after 90 hours of working together, you reach an irreconcilable breaking point, that you're down 10 hours net, and you probably shouldn't have got together in the first place.
But, now you tell me,
right? Yeah, right. Kind of thing. And you know, my parents are radical political types, and in 1970, when Pierre Trudeau imposed martial law on Canada, and when the RCMP began a campaign of dirty tricks where they burglarized the offices of radical groups to get their membership lists, to discredit their members, to insert agent provocateur. The groups became very sectarian because they couldn't date. Everything had to be marriage, right? because the amount of work you had to do to securely bring people in and integrate them into the work you were doing was so high that you had to be very sure about people to begin with. And the amazing thing about living in a time in which we can very readily find people to work with and can throw our labor together for a while with almost no cost, and then if we reach a different split up, is that we can build these political movements that are not crisply defined. And as a result, they're able to be these very broad tents, even though they represent sometimes radical politics. Now, the downside of that is the alt-right, which is obviously an incoherent movement in a literal sense, in that there are people who have diametrically opposed views within the alt-right. You may recall there was a scandal that there was a darling of the alt-right, a podcaster, who turned out to be secretly married to a Jewish woman and who viewed the anti-Semitism of the alt-right as a kind of peccadillo that he wasn't very interested in. The rest of the agenda was something he was behind. But, you know, the other side of that is Occupy and the Women's March, where because you didn't have to say why you were there, you could let lots of people turn up and be there with you. And, you know, this also is a weakness. The women's movement had a hard time going from strength to strength, or the Women's March had a hard time going from strength to strength. And, you know, the day without a woman was a lot smaller than the Women's March. But it had this strength, this amazing strength. And Walk Away is about that kind of like a projection of that kind of society where you can build a bohemia, a radical fringe that doesn't require that everybody be there for the same reason and actually allows people to be there for diametrically opposed reasons, but to be there and do the same thing and contribute to one another's projects until they can't. And one of the things that Walkaway is about is when those breaking points are reached too.
You're listening to Between the Covers on KBOO Community Radio. On today's show, we're talking with Cory Doctorow, author of the new science fiction novel, Walkaway. These are a lot of current issues that we're talking about that are actually expressed in Walkaway, which is probably within the next 100 years or so, the setting of the book.
Try to be very unspecific in the time frame, and I often throw in counterfactual elements that make it seem either much closer or much further away than the other clues do to give it a kind of no time. And, you know, that served me well. Little Brother is 10 years old, and people read it as a very contemporary technological story in part because of that.
I would imagine Walkaway will have the same effect. There's one among many issues that are discussed there is kind of the post-work world. Mm-hmm. You had mentioned earlier about the rest of us maybe not being needed by the wealthy people who run the world. So we're finding that even now with advances in technology, so robotics, self-driving cars will be around soon, drones, it means less need for human labor. The book covers this from both the dystopian aspect, meaning that we're just kind of surplus, useless to the very rich who run the world, and the more utopian angle in the Walkaway world. Can you talk about that?
Sure. Well, first let me say that there's a curious thing about our debate about automation right now, which is that the fantastically low wages in most sectors right now means that there's almost no investment in automation. When we say people are losing their jobs due to automation in unskilled and semi-skilled trades, it's not really true. Mostly people are losing their jobs because they're being offshored or because they're being onshored but moved around the country from one city to another in search of tax breaks and weak labor laws, low wages, and weak environmental protections. So places where, you know, if the capital plant can be moved readily enough, then the work can be farmed out to people who get paid less and less wages. Why would you bother buying robots when people are so cheap in the 21st century? That said, the fact that we're having all this anxiety about robots tells you, I think, that we are living in a moment in which there's a labor crisis and where we don't want to look that labor crisis in the face, that we're doing a lot of bargaining. Right? It's like if you're a chain smoker and you go to see the doctor and they tell you you have lung cancer and you say, well, what if I was to switch to organic food? Right? Nobody wants to say, well, maybe this thing that markets are supposed to do, which is to produce broadly shared prosperity in the form of, yes, maybe suppressed wages, but cheaper goods that don't require as much wages to get. Maybe markets aren't doing that. Maybe we need to actually think about whether markets are serving the purpose that we allow them to exist for. And instead we're saying, well, it's an automation crisis and not a market crisis. And, you know, if it were the case that we could make, you know, dirty jobs done by robots, that would not be a crisis, except to the extent that it wouldn't give us broadly shared prosperity. There is nothing glorious or good in the fact that all of us use toilets, but only some of us have to clean them.
Yes.
But a self-cleaning toilet, a universal self-cleaning toilet that didn't produce a dividend that was shared by the people who no longer got to clean the toilets and earn their wages that way would be a crisis, not because the toilets were cleaning themselves, but because the economic arrangements surrounding them. And, you know, I think universal basic income is another expression of this. People want to do bargaining and denial about whether markets are serving their function. And so they say, well, markets are serving their function, but we need to tinker at the margins with them in order to figure out how to get some redistributive stuff happening without actually having things like collective ownership, cooperativism, state industry, or non-market bases for allocating capital. And so we say, all right, what we'll do is we'll somehow get the rich people to pay tax, and then we'll use some of that tax to give to everybody else to buy the things the rich people get profit from, and we'll just make a loop there.
In addition to the Rebecca Solnit book, which you mentioned, and you mentioned two other books in your acknowledgments, that brought up another one, David Graeber's Debt, The First 5,000 Years. I haven't read the book, but from what I've read and what you're saying here, it actually describes the history of money and the ability to tax as an impetus to the origin of money.
Well, the ability, so it's this combination of taxation and debt. So we have this story about money, that money arose because it was very hard to make change for a chicken in cows, right?
Yeah, and replace the barter system.
We wanted a medium of exchange. There's no evidence that that ever happened. And all coin money seems to have originated with things like a conquering emperor wants to feed his troops as they march. The conquering emperor does not have a supply chain. So the conquering emperor requires that the subjugated people pay their tax in coin. And then he pays the soldiers in coin. And the only way to get the coin to pay your taxes is to sell food to the soldiers. And so the conquering emperor solves their problem of not having a supply chain to feed their troops as they march by using a combination of indebtedness and taxation. And that seems to be the origin of coin money. It's where money comes from, and it is inextricably linked with conquest and debt.
And in the utopian part of Walk Away, money is useless.
Yeah, there's a character who says, you know, if you have to pay me to do this, it means that you somehow convinced me that loving it is not reason enough, right? you've somehow managed to like do some you know mind fuck on me, so that and she's a mathematician, so that pure math no longer gives me pleasure unless someone's paying me to do it.
Right. And the third book I want to talk about, too, since we're talking about the very wealthy and capitalism and the economy, that was one that came out just a few years ago, so the most recent of the three. And that was Thomas Piketty's book,
Capital
in the 21st Century, which talks about the effects of wealth inequality, which are not good. How did that inspire you in the sections in Walk Away?
So he talks both about the effects and the causes, and I think the effects – they're both controversial, right? But among the economics profession, the kind of doctrinal economics, which is often composed of people who are either paid to provide intellectual cover for ruling elites or who are themselves members of the ruling elite because they work for big financial institutions or they're superstar economists at big universities.
Yeah, Harvard University.
Financialized
or Yale,
universities.
Right.
Piketty suggests and has the data to show that over the medium and long term, the rate of growth in the economy is slower than the rate of return on capital. And what that means is that the story of markets, which is that markets allocate capital to people who make amazing things so they can make more of them, is not true. And that markets basically allocate capital to people who have capital. At that investors are the people who get rich. If entrepreneurs get rich for creating the technologies that make us more prosperous as a society,
it's almost a byproduct.
It's a byproduct. Mm-hmm. And he contrasts three fortunes to demonstrate this very beautifully. Piketty's a wonderful writer. He contrasts Lillian Bettencourt, who is the richest woman in the world. She's the heiress to the L'Oreal fortune. She has never done a day's work in her life. And he contrasts her with Bill Gates, who founded the most successful company in the world. And Lillian Bettencourt's fortune grew at a greater rate. Her fortune, the dollars added to it over the period that Microsoft was being founded and grown into the most successful company in the history of the world, was larger than the amount of money that Bill Gates made in founding it. But then he contrasts Bill Gates, founder of Microsoft, with Bill Gates, retired Microsoft founder and investor, and finds that when Bill Gates stopped founding companies that profoundly changed the world and just started becoming a financial plumber who allocated dollars around the market, that he became richer by being a plumber than he was by being a founder. And this is a phenomenon that happens over and over again. And it suggests that even when you have temporary conditions that produce broadly shared prosperity, that those conditions are obliterated by this tendency in markets to reward capital. And one of the problems of concentrated wealth is that the delusions or peccadilloes or the dangerous bad ideas of the super rich take on an outsized importance in the policy domain when the super rich control a very large amount of capital, right? When the super, when the top percentile or decile is a relatively small amount of money, then the dumb ideas of rich people don't matter so much. But when the entire donor class that controls politics and political outcomes is concentrated into 85 hands, as it is in America, then those 85 people's weird ideas take on this incredible salience.
And that's kind of what we're seeing right now.
Sure. So, and it's destabilizing, right? So you can only, climate denial only gets you so far. And eventually the fact that half the country's on fire and the other half is drowning becomes a thing that is no longer deniable. And in the past, you know, he says, well, we had this period where wealth was super concentrated into a few hands that demanded greater and greater rents from the colonies. And the destabilization that resulted
caused
from
a revolution.
Caused World War One. And then he said that in the interwar years, those rich people were still rich enough that they wouldn't let the countries inflate or default their way out of the war debt, because all of that war debt was owned by those same rich people. They had financed the war by loaning money to governments. And that the resulting instability and the runaway inflation in Weimar and so on created World War II. But by the end of World War II, so much capital had been destroyed that we entered the New Deal era, that we entered the 30 glorious years, as the French call them, during which we had these broadly redistributive policies that created this shared prosperity. And by the Reagan years, we were back to the accumulation of capital into a few hands that could create political outcomes that put the foot on the gas to accelerate wealth inequality. So Piketty says all of this. And at the end, he says, you know, this is why the answer is to preserve market capitalism with minor tweaks around the margin, where we'll have this 1% global annual wealth tax on fortunes worth more than $100 million. And that, because the way compound interest works and because the way inflation works, that will level out and reallocate capital and make sure that people doing amazing things have the greatest access to capital, not people who started with capital. And it will create this egalitarian society. But he never says, and that's why market capitalism may not be the best way to organize our civilization, or maybe a tool rather than a philosophy. And I said in my review of it, there's a specter haunting Thomas Piketty. You know, Marx's first line in the Communist Manifesto is there's a specter haunting Europe. The specter is Marx. That Piketty is, and I'm not a Marxist, but I'm someone who is maybe Marxist adjacent, who thinks that Marx had certainly understood the disease and had some interesting ideas about the prescription, that Marx is not anyone who can be admitted into the discourse of people like Piketty, because they are serving still this market orthodoxy. Mm-hmm. And it's interesting to see in the wake of Sandersism and the broad support for Jeremy Corbyn's platform, if not Jeremy Corbyn in the UK, that there seems to be a resurgence of a willingness to at least contemplate these ideas.
And that's kind of which leads to the utopian walkaway, where mm-hmm. you've discarded the kind of capitalism that we see in the default world.
But without resorting to the kind of authoritarianism that is the traditional criticism of Marxism, because they're able to do central coordination without central authority, that they can coordinate their labor using networks that are very nimble and very responsive, instead of using bureaucrats and technocrats who sit in the capital and dictate policy to everyone else in this very paternalistic way. They have a kind of best of both worlds.
And in fact, there's this world of abundance too in the walkaway world, because things are so easily copied through 3D printing, shelter, food, medicine. There's one scene in the book where there is a disagreement between two factions in one of the first B&Bs, kind of the walkaway community. Somebody comes in and they're talking about this reputation economics, which you've gone into in previous books. Mm-hmm. And I guess you kind of refute in walkaway. And they basically, one faction just walks away and creates an alternative B&B from the ground up, because mm-hmm. they can do that rather than stay and fight or talk it out or have conflicts. They just start over.
Well, you know, I've written three books about scarcity and abundance now, Down and Out, the Magic Kingdom, Makers, and Walk Away. Uh-huh. And they represent a kind of triangle of how abundance works. So at the apex of the triangle is what we want, Because, you know, if everybody wants 25 kids, abundance has a completely different meaning than if everybody wants one or fewer.
Right.
We have a long contested history of trying to decide how much we should want. So you have the marketing industry, but also, you know, the vaccination world of like, your kid shouldn't die, right? You should have a kid and that kid should live to adulthood. That is like not a thing that everyone necessarily aspired to not many generations ago. I mean, it's actually remarkable how unthinkable and catastrophic it is for us to contemplate our own children dying. Certainly, that I can't imagine it without
worst thing that could happen to a parent.
And yet it was routine. It was routine in living memory, right? For people to have like an extra three or four kids because they knew they'd lose that many, right? So that's a thing that we contested. We contested the idea that you should be prepared to lose a couple of kids on the way, right? We have marketing, which is trying to get us to want material things, but we also have philosophies like Buddhism that says that maybe we should reject the attachment to material things. You have Marie Kondo and her book, The Magical Power of Tidying Up, where, you know, her mission seems to be to convince us all that all we want is have a single smooth river rock that reminds you of your mother, as Koire Sikra once wrote, you know. So Down and Out in the Magic Kingdom is a novel about what we could want. And then Makers is a novel about what we can make. And that's obviously another piece of it. And markets have actually been really good at making things better. In the last couple generations, we've seen orders of magnitude reduction in the material, energy, and labor embodied in our goods. So whether that's a car or a building or just your clothes, the amount of material in it has gone down radically. It's a wonderful study by some Bank of Canada economists who are IKEA fans and who'd saved a bunch of IKEA catalogs, and they used them as a data set to discover what the biggest predictor was of IKEA furniture remaining in production. And they found that it was if the furniture got lighter and occupied less cubic footage in shipping, so had required less embodied energy, then it was more likely to continue. So what's happening is that over time, IKEA engineers are figuring out how to reduce the material, energy, and labor inputs into these goods.
You have bicycles and walkaway like that.
That's
which
right.
Are reduced just to the essentials, and they seem almost like they're going to fall apart to the
That's
people
right.
riding them.
Yeah, these gossamer minimal surface bicycles, tensegrity
right.
bicycles. Yeah, and so you know when people say, well, how could we have how can you reject the degrowth agenda of, you know, having fewer people to make the world sustainable? After all, it would take six Earths for us all to live in the style of Americans. Where do you get the other five Earths from? Maybe the way you get there is by reducing the material inputs to an American's material life by 5/6,
yeah.
right? But if what we want keeps going up, which, you know, that seems to be an unbounded condition. Keynes in 1930 wrote this essay that famously predicted that by 2015, we would struggle to fill our long empty days because we could make everything we could possibly want with only 2 days work a week.
People wanted less then.
And we wanted less then. So if demand is elastic and material inputs are also elastic, what can we do to solve this conundrum of abundance? And the third corner, the walkaway corner, is how we allocate this stuff, how our logistics work. So right now a lot of our material waste is not because our things are overbuilt, but because the opportunity costs of our material is very high. You may only need a lawnmower one day every 2 weeks, 6 months a year, but if the lawnmower isn't kept in your garage, if there's only one lawnmower for your neighborhood, then the amount of labor you have to put in to finding the goddamn lawnmower on lawn mowing day and making sure that someone else isn't using it is so high that everybody ends up with a lawnmower in their garage. And necessarily, it's not a very good lawnmower, because if you're only going to mow your lawn once every 2 weeks, why would you invest in a really good lawnmower? But you can imagine a Zipcar version of fully automated luxury communism, where using networks to coordinate our resources, the thing that you need kind of trundles up at the minute you need it. And it's an amazing exemplar of what that thing can be, because it's continuously improving itself and it's being reinstantiated. And then it goes away when you're done with it.
You're listening to Between the Covers on KBOO Community Radio. On today's show, We're talking with Cory Doctorow, author of the new science fiction novel, Walk Away. Who was the writer that you had quoted in an interview? He came up with something called Spimes.
Bruce Sterling.
And actually, that's a programming concept where you have classes, and that's then when you need an object, you instantiate it, and it becomes something that you could actually use in a program.
And where now we often have dynamically linked classes in web programming, where the underlying class gets better and better, right? It becomes more and more efficient. It's relinked every time you invoke it. And, you know, there is a downside to that, which is that sometimes the libraries get poisoned by malicious software, or sometimes there was an infamous story about something called LeftPad, which is a tiny little library that lets you pad the left margin of a block of text.
Oh, and it was used on websites.
And it was used on millions of websites. And the person who made it and hosted it on this website from which all of the other websites pulled it had a dispute with them, and in a fit of pique took it down, and millions of websites stopped working all at once.
Very effective blackmail.
Or civil disobedience, or whatever you want to call it, right? Contesting. Uh-huh. That's the downside. But the thing that science fiction can do really beautifully, and we're talking about this on the drive over, is it can cleave a technology from its social and economic context. It can imagine how we might use a technology in a non-market way or in a non-authoritarian way. Or, you know, famously, William Gibson says, the street finds its own use for things. Mm-hmm. How might something used by large corporations be used by bohemians or criminals? And steampunk, you know, steampunk is a genre about people who get the productivity of a factory, but they work like craftsmen. Mm-hmm. And, you know, the motto could be called Love the Machine, Hate the Factory. That was the motto of Steampunk Magazine, Magpie Killjoy's amazing magazine. Walk Away is a bit like that. Walk Away is a bit of a story about what it would be like if we could have this amazing productivity without having the externalizing, the manipulation of public policy, the exploitation of market-driven firms. And instead you had a kind of ethically centered collective or collaborative project that was more like the firms are internally, right? You know, companies.
Yeah, they run by teams, collaboration.
Yeah, that's right. I mean, there aren't, when you get a job at a big Fortune 100, you aren't given some capital to spend that you use in a system of bids and puts to decide which team you'll be on and where your desk will be, right? You have a command economy that is built around sometimes collectivism and sometimes authoritarianism, you know. And yes, that works inside of a market, but the internals are rarely market-like. Mm-hmm. And when markets are deployed, they're deployed as a tool and not a philosophy, right? And markets may be a great way to get a certain outcome without saying markets are like a moral imperative.
Oh, Cory, I had one last question. Two. The last time we talked, of course, was about information doesn't want to be free. And in that book, you give advice to creators and artists about how to structure their business around the digital age. How are you following some of that advice in the marketing and selling of Walk Away? Not to say that you haven't followed this in previous books.
No, sure. Well, I've just launched an ebook store where I act as a retailer for my publishers worldwide. So it solves a whole lot of different problems. So the first is, it makes me a lot more money. So the normal retail cut of an ebook is 30%. So every time you buy a Kindle book, Jeff Bezos trousers 30% of that money, I get that 30%. So then I remit the remaining 70% to my publisher. My publisher takes 25% of that and sends it back to me in the form of royalty. I double my royalty for everyone who buys an ebook from me. And in that sense, it's a kind of fair trade ebook. And it lets me keep my publisher in the loop. It lets me keep my agent in the loop. But it demands of Amazon and other bookstores that they do something beyond merely formatting a text file. It says, if you want 30% of my take home on this, you need to be doing something that I can't do for myself, which I think is exactly one of the things that we want markets to do. Because I like having booksellers sell my books. I just think that the part that I can do for myself, I don't need to give them 30% for. Right. So if Amazon can recommend my book to someone who doesn't even know I exist, then they've earned their 30%. Right. That's a fair commission to pay. But I also get to sell those books with no license agreement. So, and it's the first time any major retailer has, or every major publisher rather, has had their electronic books available without a license agreement.
And that's separate from the DRM?
Yeah. So all my books are DRM free anyway. Tor Books is DRM free.
And that's been going on for a while.
It's been going on for a long time. I led that with them and they followed me into it and you know, found that it was so successful with my books that they just took the DRM off all of their books, which is great. But I also have no license agreement. So books are really old. They're older than copyright. They're older than publishing. They're older than bookbinding. They're older than paper. And there's 5,000 years of social convention around what a book is and what your rights are to it. The idea that five corporations have unilaterally renegotiated our social contract for literature just because those books are now bits, and that they've added sometimes a block of text longer than the story itself to the book, telling you what you can and can't do, that you somehow agree to merely by being dumb enough to be their customer, is pretty ridiculous. And so these books are sold with the same contract that comes with the printed books you own, which is don't break the law. Right. Don't break the law and we're
good. Don't copy my book and sell it, in other words. But you can lend it to a friend.
That's right. You can give it away. You can lend it to a friend. You can sell it used. You can do all those things. Right. There's no, if it's lawful to do, then it's lawful to do with the ebook.
You know, in preparing for the interview, I actually went back and I had read Down and Out of the Magic Kingdom probably 10, 12 years ago. Came out about 15 years ago. Oddly enough, when we're talking about Amazon here, one of the blurbs in the book is from Jeff Bezos.
Yeah, it's like the sixth book he ever blurbed.
Yeah. Yeah. But you're not such a fan of Amazon and, well, and Mr. Bezos right now.
I think, so I don't think companies are my friend. Mm-hmm. And so I don't like or hate companies. Mm-hmm. I think that they are transhuman artificial colony organisms that view human beings as their gut flora, right? Mm-hmm. And when I have an alignment of interests with the company, I'm glad of it because I exist in a market economy in which I'm trying to pay my rent and feed my family. But I don't kid myself that that means we're on the same side. We just happen to be marching in the same direction. And so there are lots of ways in which Amazon and I are adverse. So one is, you know, some monopolistic practices.
Right. But certainly the DRM.
Another is DRM on audiobooks. So Amazon won't carry any of my audiobooks in its Audible store, which is 90% of the audiobook market. They boycott my audiobooks because they're DRM free. And they say that the only way they'll carry them is if I let them lock my listeners to their platform with DRM. And so I have been self-producing my own audiobooks for the last three audiobooks and selling them everywhere except Audible. And now, because of a European antitrust thing, it looks like I'll be able to sell them in iTunes, because Amazon was the only supplier into iTunes of audiobooks as well.
Oh, so the audiobook of Walk Away will not be available on Amazon?
No, it's available as a spoken word MP3, not as an audiobook.
Oh, interesting.
Yeah. So they have
Which plays on almost anything.
Yeah. So... but you can't get it through the Audible client. Audible will only sell it if you put DRM on it.
And Amazon, of course, bought Audible.
That's right. Runs it now. And they won't. And they said at the time, we'll revisit this DRM thing. We know it's very controversial. And here we are 10 years later, and they have not revisited the DRM thing. So the audiobook for this, I mean, if I can plug it, it's a remarkably good audiobook.
You were just telling me about that with like Amanda Palmer. And
Amber Benson from Buffy, Will Wheaton, some like rock star audiobook readers, Justine Iyer, who's like one of the greats of romance audiobooks, Gabrielle DeQuire, who also directed the production, Myron Willis, Lisa Renee Pitts. So it's a wonderful ensemble cast where a different narrator stands in for each different point of view character through the book.
So how can people get that? As an MP3 on Amazon or?
Or downpour.com or my website, craphound.com, anywhere DRM-free audiobooks are sold. Mm-hmm. Yeah.
Oh, Corey, now I do have one last question.
Sure,
and this is also something we started talking about on the way over here.
Yeah.
For years, you've been a big proponent of net neutrality and not only a scholar, an analyst of what the internet can do, but certainly a huge supporter of the good parts of the internet, the advantages that come out of it. So net neutrality is basically a way of ensuring an open and free internet. It doesn't allow internet providers to kind of have a hierarchy of content, some they charge for, some they don't, or some they charge more for. It seems that right now, I mean, right at this minute, the FCC is considering certain proposals to subvert net neutrality. I was wondering, is this another example that you see of big money, the Zadas, exercising more control over the rest of us?
Yeah. So, you know, to put a slightly different gloss on what net neutrality is, because I think that's a good high-level description. But really, net neutrality is the idea that if you ask for some bits from a server somewhere on the internet, your ISP should just find them and get them as fast as they can, rather than taking bribes from some services to slow down their competitors.
Oh, I see.
Which is throttling.
What they call it is
like preferential access, right? So it's just like Safeway saying, well, it's not that we punish you for failing to use a reward card. We just raise the price of all the basics by 20% unless you use the reward card, right? The effect is what matters, not the way they describe it.
Right.
And the FCC in the last Congress passed an order that made the ISPs promise not to distinguish or discriminate against traffic based on whether they have commercial
arrangements. That was under Obama, and that's what the FCC is trying now to get
around. That's right. So the new commissioner is trying to roll back that rule, and the Senate is trying to make it so that the FCC can never make that rule. And really the reason we need this rule is that on the one hand, telecoms tend to be a natural monopoly, because there's only,
digging up the infrastructure, the roads is very expensive. That's required.
And also, you know, they are, given these enormous gifts from governments in the form of rights of way. So, you know, if you were to go around Portland and pay people for every square foot of sidewalk that you had to dig up, every place where you wanted to put a pole, every basement you wanted to run a cable into, you could never have a profitable telecom. It's only because the rights of way are given to you well below their market cost that you're able to do it. But that means that there's, you know, the city isn't going to say, well, okay, now anyone can tear up the sidewalk and put their own wires in. You end up with just one who gets the franchise. And that lack of competition means that the ISP that is screwing you generally doesn't have an effective competitor. Even if there's a cable operator and a phone company, or if you're lucky, two cable operators and a phone company, or a wireless company and a phone company, they have converged on a set of policies. And oftentimes, because there's no effective antitrust in this country and hasn't been since the Reagan
years.
You're
at the mercy of that
company. They're all owned by the same people, mm-hmm. right? The wireless company is, in fact, a division of the cable company very often, or the phone company. And so you're really in this anti-competitive desert. And the FCC says, well, competition can fix this, but we're not going to make any rules saying that there has to be competition either. And so they're basically creating a kind of crony capitalist internet future. But the thing is, we've now had net neutrality for a couple of years, and it's got good to people. People have started to realize what having a neutral network means, and people are a lot more resistant to having something they have taken away from them than they are insistent on something that they don't have being given to them.
We're seeing that with Obamacare.
And I think Obamacare is a really interesting example mm-hmm. of this, because I actually agree with the people who say that Obamacare has unstable elements to it, that letting the insurance companies charge arbitrary sums that then get paid for through the subsidy means that eventually they will gobble up the whole subsidy and reduce the kind of care that you get through the subsidy to something, you know, effectively useless. And then Obamacare collapses under its own weight. But what I think Obama did was he correctly calculated that if you gave 22 million people health care and then the insurance companies blew it up, I don't think he thought Trump would blow it up. I think he thought the insurance companies would, that they would, in their pursuit of their own individual interest, collectively make this untenable, that then people would go for single payer. That if you couldn't get single payer in when it wasn't a matter of keeping your insurance, but getting some insurance that you've never had before, people might be very suspicious of it. But if you tell them the only way you can keep the single payer that's keeping you alive, or keep the insurance that's keeping you alive,
is going to single payer,
that maybe you could ram it through. And I think that, I mean, that's what the Republican opposition said when it was brought in, right? And that's effectively what they're saying now, is that the urgency of rolling back Obamacare is that the trajectory of a collapsing exchange market
is going towards single payer, which the Republicans are against.
Just hate. Yeah.
But it might be possibly what we end up with.
Well, and that the using loss aversion as a tactic to attain the longer term strategy of single payer or network neutrality, I think that was a lot of what Obama was doing. Obama was very transactional. He was very instrumental. He didn't. His principles were things that he was willing to bend and flex on. And a lot of his principles were things that I think fell short of the mark to begin with. But he did, he came out of Chicago Democratic machine politics. He was a horse trader. And he understood that you could use a little bit of advantage now as leverage for a bigger advantage later. And so it wasn't about not letting the perfect be the enemy of the good. It was about figuring out how to to not let the check be the enemy of the checkmate, and how to box in his opposition.
It's almost like a first one's free, like a drug dealer's type of philosophy.
Yeah. I mean, it's like
you get somebody hooked, in other words, on health insurance, and then you need to keep that, and maybe single payer is the only way that's going to work.
So there's a little bit of a difference in that, like not dying is different from having your your dopamine system disrupted by opioids, but I think that the playing on loss aversion is a thing that often happens. You know, there's a thing, you know, where companies send you a free sample and say then you can send it back if you don't like it. I mean, anyone who listens to podcasts knows that there is this like recurring motif now in a lot of new entrants into the market, the kinds who do a lot of podcast advertising, like mattress startups and underwear startups and whatever.
Late night television, too, years ago.
We'll send it to you for free, yes. And then if you don't, and then you can send it back.
No questions asked.
And some of it is the hassle of sending it back, but some of it is that once you have it, you value it more than when you don't have it. The bird in the hand is worth two in the bush.
Right. Oh, Cory Doctorow, thanks very much for being here on Cable. As always, an enlightening discussion.
Oh, it was my pleasure, too.
We've been talking with Cory Doctorow, author of the new science fiction novel, Walk Away. I'm Ken Jones, and this has been Between the Covers on Cable Community Radio. Many thanks to Cory for visiting us here at Cable, and to all of you for listening.